For most of us, that's the overwhelming majority of us, the stain on humanity that was the Nazi regime is something we acknowledge with revulsion and offer what solace we can to the survivors. But for some who fail to grasp what is elementary for others, Nazi symbology remains desirable. Our state government, cognizant of the threat that right-wing extremism poses, announced last week that it would introduce legislation banning the display and possession of Nazi symbols. Now, banning it suits me more than just fine, but does it achieve the desired effect of helping to stamp out far-right extremism and the ignorance that it promotes? Instead, does it allow the issue to continue minus the Nazi paraphernalia and at the same time foment anti-government sentiment? Dr. Ben Rich is co-director of the Curtin Extremism Research Network and joins us on the phone now to discuss the likely outcome from such a ban. Good morning, Dr. Rich.
Good morning.
Well, Ben, I can't imagine any legitimate, well, except maybe an overall war museum, a legitimate use in Australia of Nazi symbols like the swastika and Iron Cross, unless one was overtly displaying their broad agreement with the racism and nationalism such symbols represented in the 1940s. Their use in this day and time in this country makes a fairly blunt and obvious statement. That is, I hate anyone that doesn't look like me. There isn't any wiggle room about the owner's outlook on life. Would you agree on that?
I would agree in most cases. I think there are certain communities. I think an example would be, for instance, wargaming communities who are interested in historical sort of representations wherein that display has a sort of a historical connection. But yeah, I would say in general, if you are, you know, out there displaying the swastika, you're either making a political statement or maybe, you know, you're an edgy teenager kind of trying to test boundaries, which is also a common usage of the thing.
So in what circumstances is displaying or possessing Nazi symbols going to be allowed and not allowed?
Well, the as far as I've been able to read with the legislative proposals, historical education, of course, so, you know, things like textbooks, museums, et cetera, as well as legitimate historical artifact collections, so, you know, the things like Hitler Youth Nights, for instance, and quite controversially displayed the swastika and are often collected by people with historical interest. But pretty much anything outside of that, whether that's things like tattoos, whether that's things like flying the Nazi flag, which has been an issue in certain communities in the recent past, those will be outlawed and come with, I believe, both potential fines and even jail time.
So, a tattoo, totally out.
Yeah, there was, I believe there was a gentleman in a particular bikie gang recently who had a tattoo on his face, and he became the kind of the centre point of discussion around these and potentially being put in jail as a result of that.
Then does it extend then into someone's house as well? Like, say if they had a swastika flag in their office, in their home office, hanging on the wall.
Well, I think they would have to have a justification for why they would have that. And again, you'd have to link that to some sort of historical interest, but could potentially be cause for legal action if they didn't have a rationale for that. Now, of course, you can make up those justifications quite easily. Maybe, again, you have historical interest, you're a collector, maybe it's a family heirloom. So it kind of does show the weakness of these types of laws. You can always kind of make a rationale for it unless you are really sort of putting down your foot in terms of your political beliefs, which some people do. But I think generally speaking, this will, you know, this is a law that comes from perhaps a good intention, but won't really address the issues it's trying to set out to confront.
Well, I guess that leads us to, I mean, we can see the potential pros of it. I mean, it's something that most of us would rather not see. It's so distasteful. What are the drawbacks of imposing such a ban on swastikas in WA?
Well, there's a number of issues. First, a lot of the groups that actually genuinely embrace some kind of right-wing extremist ideology, so I'm thinking about things like the alt-right online and their various iterations and spin-offs, are actually very adept and malleable in terms of the symbology they embrace. So they can, you know, read the laws as much as anyone else and go out there and modify the types of symbols they're associating with sort of their political beliefs. We saw controversy around this a few years ago with the flashing of the OK symbol. This, because of a series of online communities, became a sort of symbol of sympathy to racial supremacist ideologies. But at the same time, obviously, this is a symbol that most people have without sort of education in these spaces look at as pretty banal. And so you had a bunch of people out there kind of screaming bloody murder, saying, you know, these people are, you know, right-wing extremists, and everyone else kind of looking around at each other and going, well, what are you talking about? And this is just an example of the kinds of aesthetics that these groups will adopt to make their critics look hysterical, you might say. Most of these groups aren't going to be actually using the swastika. The swastika for most of these types of organizations today is seen to be a bit of old hat. You also have you know, other usage of, you know, runes associated with the Nazi party and the SS, the Schutzstaffel, which are often used in place of the swastika, which often push up very much against the kind of same aesthetics that the swastika draws on, but just don't quite cross that line. And again, are able to be argued in a legal context that they are not violating the law.
So, I mean, really, for most of the cases where people are trying to display it, it really is just a form of trolling, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, honestly, the kinds of people that are, you know, really embracing the use of swastika aren't probably the brightest sparks out there. And as a result of that, you know, you're not really addressing the fundamental issues that are driving this growing right-wing extremism we're seeing, you know, globally, really. We're really treating the symptom for the wound. And the reality is, you know, in an open liberal democracy, there are plenty of symbols that offend people. I would admit that the swastika is absolutely up there in the, you know, the top probably three. But there are many other symbols out there that offend many other groups, and we just kind of live with it because this is the nature of the society we live in. And I think, you know, for me, who works in the space of preventing violent extremism, I think what I would have preferred to have seen was the amount of resources that have been dedicated to legislating against the swastika nationally, be oriented more towards programs around public education and around building community resilience against the ideas that are attached to these hateful symbols, rather than just trying to ban the hateful symbol outright. Because I think that ultimately, as you indicated in your introduction, there is a way that this can be played off as a narrative of government overreach, of government tyranny, which potentially can lead to people being further push down those ideological rabbit holes.
But Ben, how has this sort of banning played out historically? I mean, an example you'd think, well, for me, that springs to mind would be like the Jolly Roger, the pirate flag, which, you know, in the 17th century being banned, you know, even has resonance now. I mean, obviously, a kid walking down the street, you know, with a Jolly Roger at Halloween time isn't a threat or doing anything to anybody, but you wouldn't want to go flying a black flag off the coast of Yemen.
Not at all. I think that these types of symbols can often become seen by a particular subset of society as, you know, rebel, as kind of edgy. You know, my own heritage, I'm from the United States. My great-great-great-grandfather fought on the Union side during the Civil War. And, you know, I have a particular loathing of the Confederate flag that I still see flown around, even here in Australia sometimes, because, again, it is associated with, you know, rebellion and sort of standing up to the man. And I think, you know, the more you kind of push these down, the more they kind of get that kind of notoriety. Not to say that the swastika didn't already have notoriety. And we see that groups like particularly bikies like to use both the swastika and the Iron Cross as that kind of symbol. But I think that kind of even further supercharges that kind of notion in the minds of the people that are already sympathetic to that.
If you've just tuned in, this is On The Record, and I'm Jeff Bullen talking to Dr. Ben Rich. He's the co-director of the Curtin Extremism Research Network. Well, Ben, how big an issue is the emerging threat of neo-Nazism and far-right extremism in Australia? Is it something we need to be concerned about, or is it, well, just a small slither of the population that probably dipped out on education?
Look, I think it's a growing threat. It's a growing challenge. I think there's a great book by Lydia Cahill that came out within the last year that really kind of explored the challenge of right-wing extremism in Australia. We have another book coming out with the Perth Historical Society on the history of fascism and anti-fascism by Dr. Vashti Jane Fox over at UWA, who, again, exploring these themes. And what we've really seen over the past 20, 30 years is a growth of groups and individuals pushing for a more sort of a right-wing extremist and even violent far-right ideology in Australia. We are tracking behind the United States, fortunately, but unfortunately, because of the sort of transnational nature of these ideologies today, what happens over there affects what happens over here in a much more profound way than maybe we would have expected, say, 50 years ago. What we know from just talking to the security agencies is that right-wing extremist cases represent now around about, I believe, 50% of ASIO's caseload, which, you know, 5 years ago was probably between 10 and 15% of their caseload. So this is definitely a growing challenge. And I think it's important that we continue to frame it not just as a terror challenge or a terrorism challenge, which is often our kind of instinct after the last 20 years, but as more of a threat to broader social cohesion and as a threat to our liberal democratic values. Fortunately, I think there's a growing awareness of this, both in the population as well as in the various apparatuses of state, whether that's in the policing and intelligence agencies, whether that's in education, whether that's in home affairs. But I think a lot more still needs to be done. I think a lot more resources still need to be directed towards that, particularly in inoculating society to these ideas. I think for a very long time, we were operating on a premise that, you know, we were kind of safe here in Australia, that, you know, we were a pretty moderate society overall. But I think we've kind of been quite asleep at the wheel, and this has allowed these kind of infections to come into society and start to build out their bases and look for greater degrees of support. And our only way to kind of redress that is through awareness raising and building a kind of inoculation in society against that.
So what does that inoculation look like? What, that sort of education? How do you get the message through to people that are probably going to be, well, let's say hesitant to take up an alternative point of view?
Well, I think first and foremost, educating people on the actual ideas that these kind of organisations are espousing, not just to ignore them and think that they'll go away. So looking at things like the more extreme examples, things like QAnon, things like the Manosphere Online, which often espouses quite sort of fascistic notions and kind of sort of gets into people's minds that way. Also, educating them on the kinds of techniques that are used by these groups to kind of loop people in. So oftentimes, you know, we kind of think about sort of neo-Nazis and people who espouse right-wing extremists as, you know, these guys stomping around in, you know, big black boots with, you know, shaved heads and tattoos. And what's really happened since the sort of 1970s and 80s is that neo-Nazis and sort of similar types of organizations have realized that that's quite alienating to mainstream society. And so instead, they sort of adopted this very cuddly motif, one might say, where, you know, they kind of try and build a connection to the societies that they're trying to win over. So, you know, starting up, you know, community groups. A big thing for them has been boxing and MMA gyms, where they can kind of suck people in with a, you know, a notion of community, and then start to sort of drip feed them these ideas and say, well, if you think this is a problem, maybe you need to think about the broader conspiracies that are out there and maybe who are pushing those conspiracies. So trying to allow people who, you know, may be exposed to these techniques an awareness of, oh, I'm being manipulated here. You know, this is, I'm actually falling into this space, and giving them the ability to push back on those ideas when they manifest either, you know, in these types of communities or even in broader sort of everyday encounters in society, you know, whether that's in the workplace, whether that's in their schoolroom, et cetera, et cetera. I think the general technique or the general approach over the last few decades has been to sort of put our fingers in our ears and ignore that anything was happening. But obviously that has not been a particularly effective tool and has allowed these kind of groups to slowly build up their influence.
Yes, Dr. Penridge, I definitely have to agree with you there. It has been very underground, but it is something that I've noticed has been on the increase. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us this morning on The Record. It'll be interesting to watch the reaction to the introduction of this legislation. I look forward to getting you back on the show once the legislation is through and we can, take a look at how the state's reacting.
Definitely. Look forward to it.
Thank you. That's Dr. Ben Rich. He's the co-director of the Curtin Extremism Research Network, talking to us there about our state government about to introduce legislation that bans Nazi paraphernalia, the display and possession of it. More power to them.